Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Bodang Dhammang Sanghang Namassami. Ajahn Amaro has asked me yesterday whether I could give a talk, as I'm going to Chittist this week. So it's a little bit of a goodbye for a while talk. And sitting here, it feels strangely familiar and not familiar because when I came to Amravati 20 years ago, everything was happening here in the sala. So every observance night, we were sitting here. All talks were given here. The temple didn't exist. Where the temple is now and the cloisters, there was just a big tarmac field with the pile of tires painted in gold and something like a stupa on top, and the iron, cast iron radiators from the old heating system standing in a circle around like a fence, also painted in gold. And then there was no abbot's kuti, there were just the barracks. And when I came for the first time in summer, no, the first time actually I came in 94, I thought it looks like a concentration camp. And with me being German, it was a very strange feeling. Anyway, it wasn't too bad, so I came back. And then the sala was actually the best place in the whole monastery. Every breakfast we would sit there facing that shrine. Ajahn Sumedho would sit in the middle and give reflections. And it was a real sense of community and teaching every day. And then at mealtime, everything turned to this way to this shrine, and the nuns sitting all here and there. Shall I speak louder? And we were actually eating here in the sala. Morning puja's here, evening puja's here, talks. And me growing up and from being a guest and feeling very estranged in this community to getting more familiar. And I do remember. Maybe I just go a little bit back in memory, which is, I don't know. Let's see. What I do remember is in the beginning, I was sitting here and we were doing the chanting in Pali and English. Pali was okay because it's a nice melody and I didn't have to understand it. There were not many associations, positive or negative, with the words. But in English, it was much more difficult for me. The Lord. I think some of you can probably empathize with that I felt early. I didn't want to chant that. It was so, it reminded me so much of the Christian chantings, which I had happily left behind, and suddenly I was back into the Lord. And then there were many strange things in the chanting. In my understanding, it was that, I mean, it's funny to say that when we were chanting about the Sangha, the most fertile ground for cultivation, those who have practiced well, it sounded to me that everybody was celebrating themselves, which was not accurate, politically not correct in my eyes. So I was full of views and opinions, and I thought I couldn't ordain here with this kind of chanting. And then luckily I did 1 weekend retreat with Ajahn Gunasilo in the retreat center, where he was just straightforward, you know, watching the breath, counting the breath, and I did everything, you know. And I actually got into a very calm state of mind, with the thinking more or less disappearing and getting very spacious and peaceful. And then the retreat was over Sunday afternoon, so then I came to the chanting here in the sala, and it was so beautiful, the chanting. All my critical mind had disappeared, at least for a while, a few more days, and then it was back. But at least I realized, you know, that my judgment about the chanting was not trustworthy. So that opened the doors for thinking about, you know, becoming anagarika here. So thanks to Ajahn Ariyasilo. And then I need to speak about Ginger. Ginger was a cat. Ginger was the cat here in the sala. It was his territory. There were two other cats, Sita, who was living on the nun side, actually four cats. Brutus, who was also living at the monk side, nun side, but then later was too intimidated that because we were cuddling him too much, he went over to the monks. He was more at ease with not being followed by nuns who wanted to cuddle him. And then there was Mooney, the retreat center cat, Jenna's cat. So Ginger was residing here in the kitchen. He was actually the survivor from the school times, when this was still a boarding school for children with special needs or something. So they were not very friendly to cats, but there was a pack of cats, I was told, living in the forest and living on the food leftovers, but hiding from any human beings because they were kind of catapulted with stones and not treated well. So when then the monks and nuns moved in here, they started to get more confident and turn up closer to the monastery. And Ginger was the survival cat and was actually living under the nuns' gallery in a cardboard box with a blanket, yellow blanket, woolen blanket. And getting very old. He was, I think when he died, he was 22. And very related to the sala, because so morning breakfast procedures, servery. Then the monks, the door to the nuns' gallery was opened, and the first people were sitting there. Jinder would walk straight into the sala and straight to, he would stop for a moment, look around, and then he would go in a straight line to one lap. How he did that, how he chose, I don't know. And the person, of course, who was chosen by Jinder was blissed out and had this purring cat on her or his lap. And then at some point, he would change to somebody else. But as soon as Ajahn Sumedho would enter the sala, no, sit down on his place there, whether Jinder was sleeping or purring and enjoying the cuddles, he would immediately startle, get off from the lap, and go straight to Ajahn Sumedho's lap. And enter his lap, Ajahn Sumedho would sit like this. He would never, I saw him never touching Jinder. So he was not cuddling him, but Jinder was completely attracted to Ajahn Sumedho. And then he wouldn't leave until Ajahn Sumedho would try to get up. And he would just sit curled up on his lap and sleep, very heavy and purring. And when we had poochers here, that was a bit of a problem. He liked to sit here. He liked to sit on somebody's lap while we were meditating. But then he started purring so loudly. And when he was getting older, he was starting to snore really loudly that at some point, somebody would just take him and put him into the kitchen. And then he would snore in the kitchen. You could even hear it in the sala. And then when he got older, it got the problems were getting worse because the people who would do the morning chore here, the first thing they had to remove the poo. And so in some corner it was stinking, and then we had to sniff it out where it was. And we were lucky if it was in the flower pot because then we could just empty the stuff from the pot. And if it was on the carpet, it was worse. And so then we thought about banning him from the sala completely, but it was not easy. He couldn't open the doors, but he would sneak through as soon as somebody would go through the door. And anyway, then he became very old and he wouldn't leave his cardboard box any longer. And I had to nurse him, give him food. One of the monks gave his little hot water bottle to him, which was given to him for his knee. So Jinder got very well looked after. And then Ajahn Sumedho went to Thailand, and we knew Jinder wasn't eating any longer. He wouldn't be there any longer when Ajahn Sumedho would come back. So we asked whether he could give him a blessing. And then, with Jinder on his lap, he would kind of bless him with water, and Jinder would look a little bit surprised. Anyway, and when he came back from Thailand after a month, Jinder had disappeared. We don't know exactly what happened to him. Although he couldn't walk really, he managed to get through the cat flap and disappear from the sala altogether. And we never found a trace of him. But the fox was around for a few days, so we thought that he might have had an appointment with a fox. Old forest cat. So, which was actually quite a nice imagination. So then we had no cat here. It was really missing. The whole hoo-ha with where is Jinder? What did he do? How do we get him out? Disappeared. So we were speaking about the Zen joke, I think, the Zen story of a cat living in the monastery, and there was a strict procedure what had to happen before every meditation session, where people would gather in the zendo. And one of the points which, candles, whatever, one of the points were get the cat out. And then when the cat died, they had to get a new cat to fulfill the point, get the cat out. So we were so thinking about getting a new cat. And then Sita was temporarily invited to come into the sala, but she was so badly behaved and went on the tables and into the dishes that she was banned. So since then, we don't have a cat here. And another very prominent, in my memory, very prominent event was a monk coming for a visit. I think he was a Thai monk. I don't remember his name. I think he was 104 or 108 years old, very old. He was in a wheelchair. So one evening, and I was still a laywoman, one evening there was supposed to be a talk and they rolled him in, maybe where I'm sitting now, and to give a talk. But he had dementia. And so he was sitting there and saying nothing. And then he would start in a very sweet voice to say, "What I really want to say." And then there was a long pause. "Don't do the, no, do the good, don't do the bad." Long pause. Right. And then he would gather himself, "What I really want to say." And the same thing was repeated, I don't know how many times. And people would get slowly uneasy and what's happening. And I must admit, my thinking was, this is now a little bit too much, you know, can somebody get him out here? Anyway, he was sitting quite a while and repeated this very important sentence over and over. So fruitfully that I haven't forgot it. Do the good, don't do the bad. And then he obviously felt that they would kind of ask him to leave soon. And then he gathered himself again and said, "And don't follow the light, you will be reborn as a fish." Wow. So, and then they took him out of the silo. And I just say that because, you know, when you come to the monastery and you're not so used to the monastic protocol and manners, and I was still so identified with my critical mind, I had very strong opinions about what was appropriate and what not. And I had to learn a lot. And of course, looking back, I can't quite say, you know, how I have changed. I definitely have changed. So any sense of identity has been threatened several times. And there's still a sense of identity. And, you know, I do recognize myself on photos. So. And of course, I think for all of us, it's probably true that we can't quite notice how we change. We just notice we do change. And we have some memories where we notice what has changed, you know. And maybe other people can even notice more strongly how we have changed because, it's easier to see change in somebody else than in oneself. So now, sitting here in the sala, with the temple being the lights being renovated and things checked, these memories come up. And 20 years, 22 years of monastic life, Ajahn Amaro was speaking this morning how we create our world around our interests and views and opinions, and how our projects, and how we can be so out of tune with the world of others. So we all live in our little bubble created by our clinging upadana, and upadana leads to bhava, becoming. So becoming, identifying with things. We know that there are different clingings, different ways of clingings. We can cling to sensual pleasures, whether it's food or comfort. Where's my chair? I need to sit on a chair for meditation. I saw Ajahn Bodhipala sitting behind me on a chair, and I said, "Where's my chair? I don't have a chair." "Oh, I don't need a chair. I have to sit, give a talk and sit on a chair here." Right. So I could see that part of my mind is organized, and I need a mat, I need a chair when I meditate, especially on observance nights. That was easy to give up. But sometimes it's not so easy. So we have our imagined needs and desires, and then we start to create our worlds around that. And opinions. And so in terms of food, I can eat this, I can't eat that. I like this. Oh, on the survey, I saw this. When I was traveling through India years ago, there was you go out on the river in the dawn to see the sun rising when you're on the Ganges River, and then shining on the Ghats where all the holy men and devotees are worshipping the sun and taking a ritual bath and sitting. So the hotel I was staying in had organized this trip and boat to the Ganges River, and together with other hotel guests, and they were different, completely from different walks of life, just these people sitting together in this boat. And I was already a nun, and one of them was a bit cheeky. He said, "Oh, I want to use this opportunity to find out what the secret desires of nuns are. So what is your secret desire?" And I thought, "Oh, right, what do I say?" And I just wanted to be polite and finish it. And I said, "Well, I may have a little weakness for cream cheese cake." And he said, "Oh, I will send you one to the monastery." He never did, but anyway. So, yeah, but I do notice, if there's cream cheese on the celery, oh, And at the moment, I have a diet where I don't eat any sweets and desserts. So cream cheese, goodbye. Actually, it's very liberating. The whole sweet department is, you know, I can go by and it doesn't mean anything. So it's a good training. Yeah, and as long as we are identified with it, we often don't even notice unless it's not there and we start to suffer or somebody else takes it before you. And the last piece, how could they take it? They could at least have halved it so that I could have the last half. So this Kamatana central desire are strong. They can be really right in the body. I mean, with cats, you can see that there's a mouse and they hardly see it. They are jumping on it immediately. It's like an instinct. And we have that also, that we can just, even when I have not, I don't see so well any longer, with I often can't quite see what things are on the survey, and I trust my sense. This must be what I like. So there is, even although the eyes don't quite work, there is still a sense of. So I can observe that in a slightly more detached way now. So to work with it, because you know the wish is to liberate ourselves from these desires, because they are automatically sooner or later leading to suffering, and we are here to loosen the grip of suffering. So we need to find our ways of training ourselves to, you know, cut through. But then also not trying to get rid of it, because that's another trap. Another attachment, just with a negative connotation. And so karma tanha, I think you all know your own karma tanhas. And to live the monastic life, we have really made a commitment to sense restraint. And yet, you know, it doesn't disappear automatically. We have to keep working on it. Then the other upadanas, there is clinging to views and opinions. That's in the Buddhist sense, that's also sense desire. Because we like stimulation for the mind, you know, to read a nice, even Dhamma book, you know, interesting Dhamma book, very nice. To hear a good talk, I can't guarantee. I do have a, I enjoy talks, listening to talks. I like good conversations, you know, or even good arguments. Not that I. Well, sometimes I have my opinions and get righteous and want to get my opinion over to the other person. But usually that's suffering. That's the place where I realize that clinging to views and opinions is not something I want to cultivate too much. So again, you know, the desire to, the desire for pleasant mind stimulation, pleasant mind entertainment leads to suffering. And in meditation, you may know that when nothing is going on and you don't really enjoy it. I mean, often we want that nothing is going on, but that we stop thinking to get into a blissful state of peace and concentration. But often we are not quite ready, and then we get bored and like to think, invent some interesting Dhamma reflections. Or they'd come even when they're not invited. Memories. Sometimes the stuff I'm thinking in meditation is so surprising to me because there seems to be no relevance really in the thoughts. And it's just a habit of the mind to entertain itself, just to keep going. So that's concerning. So then I develop a real wish to, you know, not follow thinking and just to let it cease. But that's easier said than done, as you may know. So we are thinking beings and enjoying our thinking world, our world of opinions and views, world views, Dhamma views. And even to go beyond that, when we chant the Metta Sutta, there's not holding to fixed views. So it's not, thought is not bad in itself, but if we start to get fixed views and identify with what we think, that's where the suffering and the becoming is. The becoming and the suffering is starting. So clinging to views and opinions. And then we have clinging to rituals, rites and rituals. That is interesting because in a way we take refuge and we take the precepts and we want to keep them. So to a certain degree we have to attach to them. That's skillful. But then what is the difference between keeping the precepts and identifying with them? Developing a sense of self, me, about keeping the precepts well. There are Dhamma teachers who teach that you have to challenge precepts, keeping the precepts, and you should break them from time to time. I don't think that the Buddha would have taught that. And there might be a little misunderstanding between challenging our identifications. I mean, even an arahant wouldn't break the precepts. So, but it's not good to become proud of keeping the precepts or keeping them better, or Vinaya, you know, keeping them better as somebody else. So that's definitely a fetter. The whole monastic training is actually a refinement, around the precepts, and to discover that our personal views and opinions, we can actually give them up, and in keeping the precepts, our preferences, just keeping the Vinaya, and it's really liberating us from our personal preferences. It may be challenging at times, but exactly that is meant to happen, so that we can see our attachments and start to let go and discover, what is beyond our attachments. And and the last upadana is the attachment to any doctrine about self, any identification with I'm this body, I'm my feelings, my perceptions, my mental formations, my sense consciousness. And really to investigate what the sense of self is made of is one of my favorite meditations. I think the Anagarikas have to suffer from that, because I'm doing the Anagarika training and guided meditations again and again with questioning, where the sense of self arises. And but it's such an important part of our practice to question that. And basically, all becoming is really connected to the tendency of establish a sense of self, and I think it's gone. My sense of self in terms of being heard by you is gone. Hello? Maybe no, it's no power cut. Hello.
It's working again.
Working again? Yeah. So thank you. So, sense of self. Yeah, the tendency of becoming, which leads to birth and then to aging and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. And it can also lead to understanding suffering and using the opportunities when we realize that we are suffering to understand what suffering is made of, and that it's not an accident, that it's actually part of human experience. And the we chant again and again the Dhammacakka Pavattana Sutta with the Four Noble Truths teaching about the, you know, there is suffering, there's the cause, there's the abandoning of the cause and the way leading to the abandoning of the cause, cessation of suffering. And so if we would attach to positive thinking and avoid any notion of suffering, just see everything in positive terms, there's very, very little opportunity to actually wake up to the truth of suffering and the way out of it. And that doesn't mean we have to just only see suffering. But I really like, I was really so, when I came to Amaravati, I was so, I didn't understand much about Buddhism at all, but Ajahn Sumedho's teaching about just be with suffering instead of struggling against it or trying to, you know, put it under the carpet with positive thinking. That, for me, that was the most liberating advice I have ever got. And that kept me going here. And everybody who has become Anagarika or has become Siladhara or Bhikkhu knows that it's not easy to live in community, but the very fact that we have this tool or these tools of working with, you know, the suffering, seeing how we are creating it, and every day, every moment nearly, having this little investigation, you know, what is the tension? How do I actually do it? What is it I'm attached to? Right. Can I let go now? Yes, maybe. So it's ongoing, ongoing, again and again. And I think it will go on for a while. And if we could just share sometimes about our suffering instead of saying, oh, I don't suffer. We are quite rarely talking about our own difficulties in the practice. And sometimes I find it really encouraging to share about that. That I don't have to defend, you know, pretend I don't struggle with my defilements. Because for me, the most important part in the practice is really, even for myself, to acknowledge that there are defilements. And goodness gracious, you know, as soon as I can acknowledge them, there's a learning opportunity. Really understanding, why am I clinging to that? That's so stupid, you know, it's so unimportant in a way, and still there's suffering. Becoming, trying to. Before coming to this talk, I was trying to think about, what am I going to talk about? And then I was speaking with Ajahn Bodhipala and said, oh, maybe I tie it to what Ajahn Amo said this morning. That seemed to be quite important. And then I thought, no, I can't start like this. I have to start with where I am. But maybe I come back to it. And then I went blank. Then I couldn't think any longer. And then I listened to a talk from Longpo Sumedho. That always calms me down. I can't plan what to talk about really, but I can have certain ideas, and then I have just to trust that things string together when I sit here. So I hope that we all have a wonderful Vasa with learning opportunities together. Yeah, it's so much easier for me to live at Amravati, where I'm part of a bigger community where we can kind of share responsibilities and have a time out instead of being always in the front line. But I will see how I manage with that, and I hopefully remember what I say now, that my practice is not becoming. So I think that is probably enough said, and I hope there was something in this talk which is useful for your own reflection. And there's definitely something which is useful for my reflection, my own reflection. So.